Support for Schooled the Podcast is provided by the Northwestern University MS Ed program in teacher preparation and teacher leadership.
You know, I don't think there's anything innately flawed with autistic neurology.
You see this as really a civil rights struggle.
And there aren't too many people who produce at my level, and I'd say it's because I have this Asperger's advantage.
I was not neurologically wired to do well within the school system as it was set up.
If you say someone has autism, it's almost like it's something being carried around in a briefcase as opposed to something that is integral to who you are.
Hey everybody, this is John O'Connor, and you're listening to Schooled, the podcast. Our show is dedicated to school stories, the stories schools tell, the stories we tell about schools, and the stories underlying those stories. On today's episode, we'll consider neurodiversity, a term signifying the amazing range of human brains, minds, and abilities, and the so-called neurodiversity paradigm, a way of looking at people that celebrates rather than pathologizes different abilities, even with respect to traits such as autism, dyslexia, and ADHD, that are often seen only in terms of deficiencies. We'll hear from Peter Smagorinsky, a distinguished research professor in the College of Education at the University of Georgia. In his 50s, Smagorinsky began to self-identify as an autistic man and credits his neuroatypicality for his prodigious scholarly output, what he calls his Asperger's advantage. We'll also hear from Nick Walker, an autistic author, educator, and activist in California, who sees the neurodiversity paradigm as a way of celebrating rather than pathologizing biological difference. For Walker, the rights of the neurodivergent to express their unique identities is a fundamental human right. Let's start with Peter Smagorinsky, an education professor at the University of Georgia. I have admired Peter's work as a teacher and professor for many years, and like many people, I've been astounded by Peter's extraordinary outpouring of scholarship, something he says occurred not in spite of, but because of his autism. I was stunned and delighted and maybe even awestruck by your piece in English Journal where you seemed to announce yourself as an autistic man rather late in your career. Am I capturing that correctly?
Yeah, I would say probably a dozen years ago when my daughter was formally diagnosed as being on the Asperger's spectrum. And I really prefer that language to saying that someone has autism or someone has Asperger's as though it's a disease. It's really, if you talk to Nick Walker, he's been very helpful to me in adjusting my language. And if you say someone has autism, it's almost like it's something being carried around in a briefcase as opposed to something that is integral to who you are. And so I always referred myself as autistic, that is exhibiting traits of autism, because it's a very broad condition and no two cases look alike. So I view myself as autistic, not as someone who has autism, as a whole bundle of traits. Mm-hmm. And so it was when my daughter was in her late teens and she got diagnosed, and I was sitting there in the meetings thinking, okay, I can't tell whether they're talking about her or me. She's got a more pronounced case than I do, but the traits are very, very similar, and I recognize them in other family members. I also have an autistic nephew who's more pronounced even. And so, it's quite a realization when at the age of 50 or so, you have to take on a whole new identity.
Right. Yeah, that must be astonishing. I did just speak to Nick Walker on your recommendation, and yeah, I thought it was kind of amazing. I was really stunned at how he sort of reframed autism as an identity and a difference to be celebrated rather than something that's pathologized.
That's right. And he and I probably think very similarly along these lines. I've never actually met him, but we've written a lot, and I think that he has thought this through very well from an emic point of view, in other words, from an insider's point of view rather than from a diagnostician's point of view. And to me, a diagnostician is trained to look for signs of illness. That's what their job is. They're not there to look and see what your strengths are. They're to see where you're developmentally behind or in some way, other way, deficient relative to some norm. And that's what they can find. But what they ignore completely is how this makeup can be an asset. And that's what I've argued very strenuously, that if you frame a person pathologically through a neurological condition, the notion that this diagnosis or characterization of you as autistic becomes the only way that people begin to see you. And so rather than looking at you as a person with myriad other strengths, they see this one deficit, and it's known as a disorder. It becomes the only thing that they see you through. And the problem then becomes when people like us begin to accept that as true, because we're told it over and over and over again, that this is a pathology, that this is a disease, that this is a something that's available for diagnosis through the DSM-6 or whatever it is now, mm-hmm. that you go to see a doctor for it. And again, it just overlooks so much about you as a human being, much of which can be advantageous. And that's, I've talked about the Asperger's advantage of, you said earlier that I am a prolific writer, and there aren't too many people who produce at my level, and I'd say it's because I have this Asperger's advantage. Throughout my career, people have always said, well, how do you get so much done? And I just thought, well, I'm pretty productive, but I actually have a whole different way of explaining it now, that I have this asset that enables me to focus and drive myself through things the way a lot of people can't in tremendous detail.
Interesting. So this insight has caused you to reframe your entire career then, it sounds like, so that you don't think that you've achieved your considerable stature as a professor in spite of your Asperger, but because of it.
Because of it, yeah. I would say that is something that distinguishes me from people who produce less. One of the things that has come out of a lot of studies of personality types and demographic markers is there's a notion of intersectionality. In other words, autism usually is not a standalone condition. It's always bundled. And it could be bundled with gender issues. You could be a trans autistic. But they also typically, as far as I can tell, intersect with other neurological differences. So with me, it works in conjunction with both high anxiety, which I take medication for, and obsessive compulsiveness, which I think is also tempered by the medication I take. And so it's actually that bundle of neurological uniqueness. Not only do I have the Asperger's attention to detail and ability to focus, I'm highly anxious, which means I have to finish things. So I'm a real finisher, because I get very, very antsy if I have things left undone. And then if you throw obsessive compulsiveness on that, it just really drives the Asperger's to even a higher level of focus, because you're always looping the same thing. And so there's an interesting intersectionality with me. Three different things that are labeled disorders actually, I think, give me unique abilities in what I'm good at, which is my field.
Right. Wow. So how has it, how has this insight into yourself and into in quotes, disorders, how has that affected your understanding of education?
Well, first of all, I would say it's not just my understanding, but my willingness to be open about it. Well, I'll give an example. I went up to Penn State last spring. I can't remember the lecture series, but it turned out I was the first person invited in this lecture series that the Center for Applied Linguistics at Penn State put on. Mm-hmm. And they actually asked me to talk about neurodiversity. You know, the talk went well. Actually, my talks are no longer talks. They're usually conversations. So I always start by introducing myself as autistic. I always say I had to take drugs to get on the plane. I had to take drugs to sit in this chair and talk to you.
Wow.
And then I open up right at the beginning with that shared information. And then I also say my anxiety is a very, a tremendous feeling of discomfort in the spotlight. And so I ask people at the beginning of a talk to interrupt me with questions at any time, rather than having me talk for 45 minutes and then have people ask questions. I invite them early, and that always changes the talk. In fact, it's very common for me to say, now I brought a talk, but I hope I don't have to give it. I'll give it if you don't have questions, but I really prefer to interact and have a conversation than just to stand up here and lecture, because that way I'm sensitive and responsive to what you're here for.
Sure.
Or at least the people who choose to speak up. So that went fine, but the reason I'm saying this is that every time I do this, I get feedback from someone or some people who, for instance, I gave a talk at Michigan State a couple of years ago, and one of the graduate students came up to me afterwards and said, I was sitting next to another grad student who said, I feel so much better after being here because I have such high anxiety, and my major professor told me I have to hide it from everyone.
Wow.
Then here I am looking at this guy who's just coming right out and saying it, and I think maybe there's nothing wrong with me after all. So I know that when I give these talks and I start out with this kind of confessional opening, there are always people there who either themselves are on any of these spectra or whose family members are, husbands, their own kids, as in your case. I always make a real empathic connection with people who feel relieved to know that they're not alone. So after Penn State, and this just happened maybe a month ago, a guy wrote me and said, hey, I've been meaning to write for months. I was at your talk when you came up. He said, I've struggled with anxiety my whole life. I always thought it was going to keep me back. But after I heard your talk, I applied to the master's program in linguistics here. It got accepted. And because I see that you've made it, I think maybe I can too. And so it's really changed I'd say that I've become so comfortable being honest about this that I've given other people a lot of comfort in being who they are. Well, I'm going to give an example from a class that I teach. I teach a class here at Georgia. It's called Service Learning and English Education. The class is designed to have our kind of high affluence students. Most of our students come from reasonable affluence. Mm-hmm. We're a public university, but we're the public university of Georgia, and we tend to get the best students. Those tend to come from affluent families, and that's an old story. So I start class every year by introducing myself with not the English Journal article, but there's another one I wrote called Confessions of a Mad Professor, which is a much more detailed version of my crisis. It was really the first thing I ever wrote on neurodiversity, and a name that I had never heard of at that time. So that's my introduction to them. I say, a lot of students want to know who their professors are, and here this tells me who I am about as well as I possibly can. It's autoethnographic. It's memoir based, but it also talks about mental health more broadly speaking. So I've been told this year after year, because I've been using this now for several years, almost since it came out. Students say that when I do that the first night of class, it changes everything, because there are always students out there who are highly anxious. I always have students who are medicated. and you probably know this in the high school level too, you got a lot of Medicaid students, right?
Absolutely.
There's a lot of anxiety out there, but the class itself becomes very confessional.
What an amazing gift to give your students to create that kind of space. Are there specific conditions that you've identified or maybe that you're attempting to address in schools that make schools, you know, less than fully accommodating, or, you know, what are the conditions that are most difficult for neurodiverse students?
Well, I would answer that in two ways. And you're a nutria, right?
Yes.
And every year or so, students in that class read Savage Inequalities, which features nutria in comparison to East St. Louis. And they talk about the seven gyms and y'all got some money up there. Schools in Georgia don't.
Right.
And when schools are underfunded, they cut things that really cripple the prospects for these kids. So, well, there's less money for counseling. There's no school nurse. There are fewer programs and things like arts and drama that these kids can get involved in. There are fewer niche activities available for kids, like maybe an anime club, the sort of thing my daughter would have liked. But people on the spectrum tend to have these weird, narrow interests. So I would say that the absence of funding that the public is willing to dedicate to education, I don't know what they think they're achieving other than paying less in taxes for themselves, but they're making life hell for kids who need services, who need a little extra attention. Special ed gets reduced. Not that special ed is always a good thing.
Right.
It can be very pathologizing. A lot of mainstream special ed is oriented to pathology, even as there are a lot of special ed teachers who are very caring. But I would not start with different conditions. I would start with how schools are funded or not funded in ways that make taking care of anybody with special needs almost impossible. So when my daughter was in high school, she went to different high schools. When she ended up at a public high school, terribly underfunded, had a part-time counselor who had retired and they didn't have enough counselors, so they brought a few back part-time. So she actually had a part-time counselor who had no understanding of neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. And so his solutions were all that we needed to be more punitive with her. And my view was, well, if I want her to commit suicide, that's exactly what I'll do, because this is a kid I had sat at the dinner table with for maybe an hour while she ran a knife up and down her arm, wishing she could cut herself. I'm going to be tougher on her, right?
Mm.
Really lay the law down. That's what she needs. And so it's one thing when teachers don't get it, because where would they get it? It's another when counselors don't get it, because they're supposed to.
Yeah.
And so when you have so few people in the school who get it, these kids are going to continue to get terrible treatment. So they're going to be treated terribly. They'll be viewed as just bad kids, kids with bad character, kids with bad parents, kids who are bad to rotten to the core or whatever, as opposed to kids who are put together differently, don't fit in the school structure very well, thrive on narrow interests. One of the cases I've made about English classes is the kids are, let's say a kid only reads Judy Blume books. I don't know, this probably dates me as someone from 100 years ago. Let's just say a kid only reads Judy Blume books, and the teacher says, no, you've got to broaden your horizons. No, there's something wrong with only reading one thing. You got to be more narrow. Well, if someone on the spectrum is going to seethe with frustration over that, because that's not what they're built to do. They're built to take Judy Blume and read everything she's ever written and then read everything about her. Obsessive compulsiveness involves obsessiveness, you know?
Right, for sure.
You can't just assign that out of a person. So schools themselves are not designed for people who, they're not designed for anyone who's not, doesn't fit the notion of the norm, whether it's black kids or immigrant kids or neurodiverse kids or lots of kids. They just don't get served well in school, and schools tend not to be flexible to begin with and then cut services that serve those kids who are, you know, these kind of socially marginalized kids, as autistic kids often are. So that's where I'd start. I'd start with the fact that the public doesn't seem to care, and that's reflected in the kind of decisions they make about millage, votes, and any kind of taxation. So that comes back to the second question of how about, are there particular things that are more difficult to deal with? So I think that the thing that schools can most easily deal with is ADHD, because you can medicate it. I'm not saying that's good, but I would say that schools are best equipped for things that they can give a pill to. Because that is a sort of painless way of normalizing the kid's behavior, or at least trying to normalize the kid's behavior. And so everything I've thought about has been how do we construct channels of activity through which people can participate? That's really what I'm interested in. So I can tell you, for my daughter, the anime culture provided her with a place where no one thought she was weird. Everyone admired her art. It was a place where she got continual affirmation from people in ways that almost no place else in her life she was getting. So it was finding that social niche that she could thrive in that I think enabled her to feel good enough about herself that she didn't want to commit suicide, and that she formed friendships that she wasn't forming elsewhere, and viewed herself as a valued, productive person, not just from those individuals, but from this whole community of practice. That to me is a social solution to what people view as an individual neurological problem. Not to change the kid, but to find a place for the kid where she can thrive.
Thanks so much to Peter for sharing his stories. Later, we also had the chance to speak with Nick Walker, an author, speaker, educator, and activist in California. Walker is an autistic man whose work celebrates the unique identities of the neurodivergent. I asked Nick how his autism was characterized when he was a student.
Variously. Like many autistic people of my generation, I accumulated an amazing list of incorrect diagnoses depending on the bias of the therapist or psychologist or whoever was diagnosing me and how much they liked me or didn't like me. So it was everything from, you know, oppositional defiant disorder to ADHD to schizophrenia to personality disorders. I was not neurologically wired to do well within the school system as it was set up. So depending on the stage in my development, you know, there were periods in my development where I was non-speaking. The tendency was to assume incompetence on my part and to diagnose it as intellectual impairment, mental retardation, you know, some sort of use deficit. If I was in a stage of my development where I was speaking articulately, then it was decided that I was highly intelligent, and therefore any time that I didn't comply with how the teachers and psychologists and such wanted me to behave, it must be an intentional misbehavior, act of defiance. And so then I would accumulate, you know, diagnoses like oppositional disorder and personality disorder and conduct disorder. And that eventually emerged as a general consensus that I was just a bad kid. So eventually I got thrown out of the public school system and put in a school for mostly juvenile delinquent type youth, and I was there for a few years, and then I came back to public school and high school and all that. And that was actually a good development for me to get out of the public school system for a bit. And I think I did probably had a better experience being in with the juvenile delinquents than I would have in some school that was specifically designed for autistic kids.
Wow, that's quite a statement. Is there ever a point at which disability becomes pathology for you? Or, I mean, is there ever a point at which a disability can be so debilitating in someone's life that it would really need to be repaired so that a person would be able to function on some basic level?
This is a very complex topic, possibly one that we don't have time to cover completely today, because there's a great deal of complexity to it. The lines are always fuzzy and always context dependent. I guess clarifying a few terms is helpful here. When I think of, you know, pathology, you know, to label something a medical disorder, that's essentially saying there's a defect at work. This person is not working, not functioning optimally. There's something impairing their ability to achieve their best potentials that's located inside them. And distinguish that from disability. And I think in terms of what's called the social model of disability rather than the medical model of disability. But I think it's more useful to think in terms of this social model. And the social model of disability is saying, you know, this person, because of the way this person functions, they are disabled in certain contexts if they're not accommodated. So the degree to which a person is disabled depends on how well the culture and the social structures and systems around them accommodate their needs. And so in that sense, my argument here is that autism is not a pathology. It's not a defect in a person. Autistic brains and bodies function as they should. But autistic people are disabled because within a social context, within a culture that doesn't accommodate autism, that they demand that they be other than they are and doesn't have the supports for them. So a neurotypical person, a person whose neurological functioning is similar to that of most of the population, has neurotypical privilege. They're not disabled because everything around them is set up to specifically accommodate the way that they function. We live in a society set up by and for neurotypical people, and to the extent people are neurodivergent, they diverge from the neurotypical by being autistic or something else, bipolar, dyslexic. They're disabled because their way of being is not accommodated or recognized as valid. So that's a crucial distinction. You know, I don't think there's anything innately flawed with autistic neurology. And the other neurology, I also believe in what's called cognitive liberty, the right of each person to do what they want with their own consciousness, their own brain. So in that sense, anybody has a right to decide, I don't like how my brain functions and I'm going to do things to alter it. And I also think that's perfectly acceptable. Nobody's required to say, I'm going to work with my brain exactly as it is, because we have so many means available to us to alter our consciousness, and people should be able to do it if they want to.
When I think of liberation pedagogy, it's usually seen in terms of social class or maybe even in racial terms, but increasingly I think the LGBT community has been so persuasive in highlighting heteronormativity, for example. So you see this as really a civil rights struggle in that same way, don't you?
Yes, again, it's the same thing. It's a struggle against enforced normativity. There's a lot of similarity between LGBTQ struggles and neurodivergent struggles, in the sense that it's a struggle against the enforced performance of normativity and a struggle against societal pathologizing and prejudice towards deviations from the normative. And there's a lot of overlap because, you know, one of the great things to come along from queer theory and gender theory is this idea of gender as performative, that people are culturally trained to perform gender roles in particular ways. The idea of normativity is these huge taboos against deviating from the established standards of performance. That is very much the case with performance of neurotypicality too, that there's this huge prejudice against deviations from the performance of neurotypicality. And they overlap because divergence from neuronormativity, autism and other forms of neurodivergence, also affect one's gender performance. So the autistic community tends to be a gender nonconforming community. There's a lot more gender nonconformity and queerness within the autistic community, I would say, than within the general population.
Where do you see schools being most intolerant or inflexible? Or where do you see schools instantiating neurotypicality most in the classroom?
I think that there's two areas of particular rigidity that are maybe the most extreme points that if we change those can create other changes. And one of them is about physical embodied performance of normativity, that certain just ways of moving and speaking and being an embodied person are pathologized. And so autistic people, because they have a different way of thinking and perceiving, also have different ways of moving. And so this intolerance that says, you know, it's bad to be weird and different, so you have to move like everyone else. You know, you have to sit still at this particular time, sit in this particular way, look people in the eyes. That's impairing the functioning of autistic people, because everybody's brain functions best and everybody learns best when they're in a position where their body can move according to what it needs to do. And so that's one area. And the other, which it overlaps somewhat, is about communication and what ways of communicating are legit. There's two phrases that exemplify this, and one is look me in the eye, mm-hmm. This idea of, you know, our cultural attachment to eye contact that's not good for autistic people. And the other is use your words, and this idea that oral communication, speaking aloud, is the legitimate way of doing social communication. And of course the result of that is that autistic people who can't speak and communicate best with typing or some similar form of augmented communication, they tend to be dismissed as intellectually inferior and underestimated and not given learning opportunities. And so an environment where autistic ways of communicating are accepted and taught as completely valid forms of communication, the same way that different languages are accepted as valid forms of communication, you know, it's going to be better. You know, that's a huge thing that schools could do, is instead of trying to force autistic people to communicate like non-autistic people, create opportunities for typed communication and pictorial communication, other forms of communication in the classroom, which becomes a learning opportunity for everybody involved.
Thanks so much, Nick, for sharing your stories and for offering all those good ideas.
Great. Thank you very much.
Albert Einstein famously remarked that everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid. This idea gets to the heart of the neurodiversity paradigm, an idea that requires a fundamental paradigm shift in support of the basic human right of self-expression, and one that calls for a focus on the unique abilities of the neurodiverse, rather than judging them in terms of how far they fall short of the abilities and worldview of neurotypicals. I want to thank our guests, Peter Smagorinsky and Nick Walker. Thanks also to Tom Couch for producing today's show. Additional thanks to Charles Logan for editorial help with this episode. Our theme music was provided by Sally Graham and the Flammable Dresses, with additional music by Andrew Klinkman. If you like what you heard, please visit our website, schooledthepodcast.com. That's schooledthepodcast, one word, .com. There you'll find additional episodes, further information about our guests, and short essays on education on our new School of the Podcast blog. Please share the link for our show with your friends and help us spread the word by offering your thoughts on Facebook and Twitter. And thanks again for listening to School the Podcast.